in any way. Once established in this state of perfect calm, protected by mental armor as sensitive yet impervious to harm as an elephant's hide, the meditator can begin the work of realizing the perfect enlightenment that will loose the bonds of suffering. Among all the world's religious traditions, the unique contribution of Buddhism may have been to demonstrate that, if you wished, you could remove supernatural beings from the picture and start investigating the mind solely for the purpose of improving well-being. Having shown the gods the door, essentially what we were left with was psychology. According to this new perspective, our minds are fundamentally pure but have become contaminated by the poisons of craving, aversion, and delusion, which are said to be the roots of all suffering, from anxiety and fear to jealousy and depression. The first stage of meditation, calm, helps you resist these defilements and see them more clearly, while the second, insight, allows you to discern the true nature of the mind and start travelling the road leading to the final, perfect enlightenment. For Siddhartha Gautama, it wasn't enough to be engulfed by the cloud of unknowing, as the Carthusian monk would describe it almost 2,000 years later, and wait patiently in the darkness for his soul to be united with God or the universal consciousness. To attain the final enlightenment, he must somehow pierce the cloud once and for all. Like an airborne mountain range, heavy black monsoon clouds roll in from the Indian Ocean far away to the southwest. They hide the sun and plunge the park into a premature twilight. Lightning in the east heralds a dull rumble of thunder, and at last, the first fat drops of the rainy season kick up the dust around the tree stump. Soon they're falling thick and fast. The long, dry summer is over, but none of the starving men shows any inclination to find shelter. They barely seem to notice the rain even as it soaks into their hair and beards. The meditating ascetic remains motionless in the dirt as the drops trickle in rivulets down his weather-worn face and tumble over the bark and feathers that pass for his clothes. Kondanya is the first to see him, a distant figure walking toward them through the rain. For a long time, the old man seems uninterested by this other being, until a flash of lightning freezes the raindrops in midair and illuminates him. Kondanya gasps and struggles to his feet, then rouses the others. After a moment's hesitation and disagreement, they hurry to meet Siddhartha, greeting him as a friend. Something in his demeanor quells their former reservations. All has been forgiven, and just three words from their teacher are sufficient to convey the momentous thing that has happened to him since they parted 2 months ago. I am awake. Chapter 4. The Second Dart. So I too found the ancient path, the ancient trail travelled by the awakened ones of old. Samyutta Nikaya, 1265, translated by Nanamoli Thera. The downpour comes to an end almost as abruptly as it started, leaving the air brilliant and clean. They find a log for Siddhartha to sit on, and one of them somehow conjures up water and a towel so he can wash his feet after the long journey. There is something different about him. They can see it in his eyes. He begins to explain his reasons for giving up the extreme form of asceticism they have all been practicing these past few years. It is perfectly true, he says, that to devote your life to sensual pleasure is base, vulgar, common, ignoble, unprofitable. But to devote yourself to the opposite extreme, to punishing the body until it becomes weak and useless, is just as ignoble and unprofitable. Once he had realized this, he resolved to develop a new approach that steered a middle course between the two extremes. This led to a sense of profound peace, to the insight and spiritual awakening they had all been seeking for so long. In keeping with this new middle way, they must eat. So, before he continues, Sitatus sends three of them into town for alms. While they're away, he begins to teach the other two, and later, when the first group has come back with food, he instructs them while the others go for alms. He teaches them the four noble truths: suffering, its cause, its ending, and the path that leads toward its ending. He tells them they must recognize, investigate, and understand each of these truths for themselves if they want to realize enlightenment. Suffering is a basic fact of existence, he says, and the cause is attachment to pleasures and the urge to be rid of anything unpleasant or painful. We are like deer caught fast in a trap, he says, waiting helplessly for the hunter to return. But we can free ourselves by following a path of wisdom, ethical conduct, and concentration, the Noble Eightfold Path. This will end suffering by liberating us from all cravings, aversion, and delusion. The men and women living at Amaravati Buddhist Monastery on the hilltop in the Chiltern Hills of southeast England are direct spiritual descendants of those five ascetics who became the newly enlightened Buddha's first followers some 25 centuries ago. I had the pleasure of staying at the monastery in the summer of 2014, and it was a revelation. Buddhist monks and nuns all over the world still subscribe to the Four Noble Truths and follow the Noble Eightfold Path. See Figure 1, page 77, that the Buddha is said to have outlined that day in the deer park at Isipatana, now called Sarnath, in northeast India. They too chart a middle way between the extremes of sensory indulgence and punishing austerity, though to an outsider like myself, the monastic life looks anything but easy. Monks in the Theravada tradition of Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma, Cambodia, and Laos must adhere to 227 rules. Fully ordained nuns have somehow been landed with no fewer than 311 rules, which govern every aspect of their lives. Their only real possessions are three robes and an alms bowl. They eat just once or twice a day, always before midday, and they regularly fast, living for days on nothing but water, filtered to avoid killing any living creature, no matter how small. While the rest of us dream of a day when we'll want for nothing, their objective is to want nothing. They must remain celibate and penniless and may not take anything that hasn't first been offered to them. Chatter is discouraged, and many choose to observe noble silence much of the time. At Amaravati, which is the largest Theravadin monastery in Europe, the monastics don't listen to music, watch television, use mobile phones, or have access to the internet. And the only books in their library are about Buddhism and spirituality. Much of their waking lives is spent in meditation, mostly in isolation in their kutis, rustic huts in the woods that border the monastery. Anyone visiting such a monastery for the first time will be struck by an apparent contradiction. How can the road to Nirvana, popularly viewed as an almost magical realm where everything is just fine, be paved with so much physical and mental deprivation? In truth, the Buddha never promised anyone eternal happiness and freedom from pain. He simply pointed out a way to transcend suffering. A monastery is a boot camp for the mind, if you will, providing intensive training for those who aspire to the incomparable peace of enlightenment. Isolation and strict discipline help the monastics to loosen the grip of their worldly attachments, which, according to the Buddha, is essential to realize this goal. See Figure 1 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. As guests at Amaravati, we had to observe just 8 basic precepts during our stay. We were obliged to show restraint in our behavior, no games, makeup, music, mobile phones and so on, and to refrain from intentionally killing any living creature from stealing, sexual activity, lying, overindulgence in sleep, eating after midday, and ingesting intoxicating substances. We were also encouraged to play a full part in the life of the monastery by cleaning and helping out in the kitchen and grounds, and by attending the hour-long morning and evening observances, puja, in the meditation hall. Most of this was not particularly onerous. The food at the midday meal was tasty, plentiful, and nutritious. Tea and coffee were allowed throughout the day, and a bit of gardening and dishwashing never hurt anyone. But meditation can pose a major problem for those not used to sitting cross-legged on the floor for long stretches. At 5 a.m. each morning, we would gather in the dimly lit meditation hall to kneel before the gilded image of the Buddha. When everyone was ready, a monk went forward to light a stick of incense on the simple, unadorned altar. Then, as the sweet scent filled the air, he led us in a chant. To the Blessed One, the Lord who fully attained perfect enlightenment, to the teaching which he expounded so well, and to the Blessed One's disciples who have practiced well. We bowed three times. To the Buddha, the Dhamma, his teachings, and the Sangha, the monastic community, often known as the Triple Gem of Buddhism. Once the chant had finished, everyone settled cross-legged on their cushions, a bell tinkled, and complete stillness fell. Almost straight away I began to regret my habit of meditating in an armchair back at home. I wasn't used to sitting bolt upright with my back unsupported, each of my long, middle-aged legs bent painfully at the knee like a pair of rusty old pliers. I don't think my body had assumed such a position for any length of time since I sat with the other fidgety kids on the floor during morning assembly at primary school. Soon my lower back, knees and ankles were screeching in protest, and my mind was in a turmoil over how long I would have to endure this pain before the bell rang to signal the end of the session. 30 minutes later, when I finally gave in, uncrossing and stretching my legs and opening my eyes, I saw that the shaved domes of the monks' heads were as immobile and their backs as straight as they had been at the start, and yet they were somehow perfectly relaxed. They had entered a realm of stillness and composure to which I did not have access. Jon Kabat-Zinn trained under several Zen Buddhist teachers in the 1960s and 1970s and remembers well the discomfort he felt during his early experiences of meditation. "When I started practicing on intensive retreats, it was actually very painful," he tells me. "The first one I took, we made a vow not to make any voluntary movements for periods of up to an hour and a half, 2 hours. I learned an awful lot about pain. Retreats could last weeks, during which dedicated practitioners would sit cross-legged for more than 8 hours each day." One of the most important lessons that Kabat-Zinn learned from this experience was that by changing one's mental attitude toward pain, its sting can be drawn. There is a distinction between pain, which is part of the human condition, and suffering, which is something that we can compound when our minds become inflamed because we don't like what's happening. This is fundamental to the whole practice. The lesson stayed with him, and in 1979, when he developed the Stress Reduction and Relaxation Program at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center in Worcester, he began applying it for the benefit of patients suffering from chronic pain that conventional treatments such as painkillers and surgery hadn't been able to shift. Many of these people have been experiencing debilitating pain for several years. Their doctors had simply told them, "You're going to have to live with this." It was Kabat-Zinn's job to help them learn how to live with it. Clearly, there is more to our experience of pain than the alarm signals pinged to the brain by sensors scattered all over the body. in our skin, muscles, bones, joints, and internal organs. The way we think about the painful sensations and the emotions associated with such thoughts are just as important. The Buddha understood this intuitively and had a neat metaphor to explain the insight to his disciples. It is as if a man were pierced by a dart, and, following the first piercing, he is hit by a second dart, he told them. He worries and grieves, he laments, beats his breast, weeps, and is distraught. So he experiences two kinds of feeling, a bodily and a mental feeling. Someone who hasn't been taught how to cope with painful sensations resists and resents them, the Buddha said. The only way he knows to escape the suffering is by distracting himself with sensory pleasures, which, as he taught in that first lesson in the deer park, come with dangers of their own attached. On the other hand, he said, a well-taught noble disciple, O monks, when he is touched by a painful feeling, he will not worry nor grieve and lament, he will not beat his breast and weep, nor will he be distraught. So even if the first dart had found its mark, the second one could no longer hurt him. This is not merely theoretical speculation. Examples abound of highly trained Buddhist monks enduring tremendous physical pain without flinching. The archetypal case being the self-immolation by fire of Quang Duc. Thich Quang Duc, in Saigon on June the 11th, 1963, in protest against the discriminatory policies of South Vietnam's government. American photographer Malcolm Brown's extraordinary photograph, which was featured on the front pages of newspapers around the world, shows the 67-year-old monk immobile in the lotus position, as his body was consumed by flames. While this is obviously an extreme example, it illustrates the mind's potential for enduring the most intense forms of pain imaginable. But what of the everyday pain experienced by more ordinary folk? Even in this era of high-tech analgesics and anesthesia, pain still causes a great deal of suffering. As many as a third of adults experience some kind of chronic pain, and this figure rises with increasing age to more than half of those over 75. Pain is associated with psychological distress and decreased quality of life, and it puts severe limits on everyday activities. In the United States alone, it has been estimated to cost a staggering $635 billion a year in medical treatment and lost productivity. In the hospital where Kabat-Zinn set up his clinic, doctors working in almost every department began to refer to him patients suffering from stress and anxiety related to a wide variety of conditions, not just chronic pain, but also illnesses such as heart disease and cancer. He was essentially teaching mindfulness without the religious and cultural overlays of Buddhism. The course lasted 10 weeks, comprising homework and a two-hour session once a week, during which patients were instructed in mindfulness meditation, the body scan, gradually sweeping their attention from their feet to their head, and hatha yoga postures. Mindfulness meditation involves first focusing one's attention on the sensation of breathing, as described in the second chapter, eliciting the calming relaxation response, then opening up the field of awareness to include physical sensations, thoughts, memories, and emotions as they arise. The meditator is taught to observe all these simply as passing mental events without evaluating them or getting caught up in them. You can try this meditation by following the detailed instructions at the end of this chapter. The secret Kabat-Zinn learned as a young man and during grueling Zen meditation sessions is that if you can turn your full attention on pain without pursuing the emotional narratives that usually accompany it, you suffer much less as a consequence. It is a skill he still teaches to patients with chronic pain. We don't just tell people accept it and it will be okay, he says. But, paradoxically, when you begin to befriend your pain, move into it, embrace it, hold it in awareness, you begin to see that the suffering lies in thinking, this is going to last forever, and it's destroyed my life, I'm never going to be better again. That's not actually pain. Those are just thoughts. He admits that this change in perspective is a challenging thing to ask of someone experiencing debilitating pain. But he says the key to reducing the suffering associated with an intense sensation is to turn toward it rather than try to run away from it. That's where the rubber meets the road. In 1982, Kabat-Zinn published results of the first clinical investigation into the efficacy of mindfulness meditation for easing chronic pain. There were 51 patients in his study experiencing various types of pain, mostly lower back, neck, and shoulder pain, and headache. Having completed the 10-week course, 65% saw their pain reduced by more than a third, when scored on a standard index that combines pain intensity and unpleasantness. In half of them, pain ratings had fallen by more than 50%. These changes in the patient's ability to cope with their pain were accompanied by significant improvements in mood and psychiatric symptoms. Here was the first evidence that Kabat-Zinn's program, which is now known as Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, or MBSR, and generally lasts 8 rather than 10 weeks, had clinical benefits. In the ensuing 3 decades, there have been thousands more studies with clear benefits established for pain, stress, and anxiety. The program has also been successfully tailored to prevent relapse in depression. See Chapter 6, Golden Slippers, and Treat Addiction, see Chapter 7, Fire Worshippers. In all these diverse applications, the two darts approach is applied. Patients are encouraged to recognize the distinction between the discomfort itself, whether that's the bodily sensations associated with stress and anxiety or drug withdrawal, and the suffering we create around those sensations by our emotional reaction and the struggle to push them away. Mindfulness means accepting that some experiences are unpleasant without getting caught up in them emotionally or trying to push them away. Kabat-Zinn has always believed that he is teaching people a life skill rather than providing a one-time treatment. There is no age when it's not valuable to learn how to handle stress, he told me. Research has shown that chronic stress depresses our immune systems, worsens inflammation, affects nerve growth in the brain, and raises the risk of cardiovascular disease. If you learn how to deal with stress and self-regulate, and the same is true of stress-related pain, whether it's headaches, migraines, or more serious things, then you increase your chances of staying healthy. And all that comes out of a greater awareness of your own mind and your own body and your own relationship to stress and pain, as well as what gives you pleasure in life and what gives you joy and satisfaction. Since Kabat-Zinn developed MBSR in the 1980s, studies have investigated its potential worth in a wide variety of settings, from children taking exams to cancer patients going through the psychological trauma of their diagnosis and subsequent treatment. It is worth noting that in recent years, the methodological rigor of many of the early mindfulness studies has been called into question, as the standards expected of psychological and clinical research in general have been raised and the bar for proof of clinical benefits is now set much higher. I explore some of these issues in Chapter 11, Mind Mirrors. At the same time, it should be recognized that a new approach to treatment takes time and resources to garner enough hard evidence of efficacy. The early studies were necessarily small and exploratory in nature. From the start, Kabat-Zinn acknowledged the shortcomings of his pilot study in 1982 on the worth of MBSR for treating pain, including the lack of a control group against which to compare the treatment and potential biases in patients' reports of their pain. For example, they may have exaggerated the benefits of the program simply to be nice to their teacher. He also wrote that ideally in this kind of study, an independent panel rather than the investigator himself should interpret some of the pain measures. 3 years after the publication of this preliminary work, Kabat-Zinn did indeed publish a bigger study, carried out with the help of two independent collaborators at the hospital, in which he compared 90 chronic pain patients who took his mindfulness course with patients who continued to receive standard treatments. He found statistically significant improvements on self-reported pain measures and reductions in anxiety and depression compared with standard treatments. By the end of the course, patients were also using less pain medication. Remarkably, the psychological improvements were still evident up to 4 years later, with the majority of patients reporting that they were keeping up their meditation practice. Interestingly, the intensity of their pain was unchanged from before the mindfulness program, but they were coping with it better. In other words, it was less likely to be dominating their lives. Kabat-Zinn's research tends to involve mixed groups of patients with a variety of conditions. More recent studies are providing evidence that mindfulness can improve quality of life and reduce the discomfort associated with specific chronic pain conditions, including lower back pain, back-neck pain, arthritis, irritable bowel syndrome, and fibromyalgia. Still, much clinical research remains to be done to establish just how good mindfulness is for easing the suffering associated with chronic pain and which types of patient might benefit most. The neuroscience of pain, with its complex interplay of alarm signals from sensors around the body, beliefs, emotions, and thoughts, is also still in its infancy, with many mysteries yet to be solved. Nonetheless, researchers are beginning to unpick how meditation affects the way pain perception is processed in the brain. Suppose a time-travelling neuroscientist were to journey back to the 5th century BCE at regular intervals to scan Siddhartha's brain. From those early years practicing meditation with his fellow ascetics through to his enlightenment, what would he or she discover? And what might the findings tell us about pain and suffering? Lab-based studies suggest that even beginners, much like the 29-year-old Siddhartha after he left his father's palace and began his spiritual quest, can dramatically change their experience of pain using mindfulness meditation. In 2011, researchers led by Fadal Zidane at Wake Forest University School of Medicine in North Carolina found that men and women given just 4 sessions of mindfulness instruction, each lasting only 20 minutes, were able to reduce the unpleasantness of pain caused by a heat probe applied to their legs by 57% on average. And they reported the meditation reduced the intensity of their pain by 40%. During the experiment, the subjects lay with their heads inside the donut-shaped magnet of an MRI scanner, which revealed that changes in the perceived intensity and unpleasantness of their pain were associated with distinct regions in their brains. Reduced unpleasantness correlated with increased activation of an area at the front of each hemisphere of the brain immediately above the eye sockets, in the orbitofrontal cortex, a part of the prefrontal cortex involved in assigning an emotional charge to incoming sensory data, which is vital for learning and decision-making. Reduced pain intensity was associated with increased activity in an area further back on the inner surface of each hemisphere, known as the anterior cingulate cortex, ACC, which detects conflicts between tasks competing for attention, and is also known to play a vital role in pain perception. See Figure 2, page 87. The cingulate cortex curls around the corpus callosum, the tract of nerve fibres connecting the two hemispheres of the brain, rather like a collar. Cingulum is Latin for belt or girdle, and cortex means the outer layer or rind of something. Reduced pain intensity was also accompanied by greater activation in another cortical structure called the insula, hidden deep inside the brain within each hemisphere, tucked into a fissure between three lobes. The insula is involved in the experience of emotion, awareness of internal bodily sensations and of their salience. In other words, how worthy of our attention they are amid all the other sensory data. Both the ACC and insula feature prominently in results from meditation brain research. It has even been suggested that between them, they create the sense of conscious awareness, an extraordinary claim whose significance I examine in more detail in Chapter 10, Wonderful and Marvelous. Research suggests that the signature of pain in the brains of more experienced meditators is different from that of beginners. See Figure 2 on the enhancement. When Joshua Grant at the University of Montreal and his fellow researchers used fMRI to scan the brains of Zen meditators with at least 1,000 hours of practice under their belts, they actually saw reduced activity in the prefrontal cortex during pain compared with controls. Activity was also reduced in the amygdala, which is closely involved in strong emotions such as fear and anxiety, and a seahorse-shaped structure called the hippocampus, where these kinds of memories are stored. Meditators with the most experience had the largest reductions in activity in these three brain regions. Other differences became more pronounced with continuing practice. Grant and his colleagues found that activity was greater in parts of the brain's cortex that are directly involved in processing painful sensations, including the insula and ACC, and that these cortical regions are thicker in both Zen practitioners and controls who have lower pain sensitivity. These findings make sense because, as we've seen, mindfulness involves turning toward pain, focusing one's whole attention on it rather than trying to evade or suppress it. Similarly, Grant's discovery that the prefrontal cortex of experienced meditators goes quiet during pain also accords with the stated aim of mindfulness, which is to pay attention to sensations without passing judgment or trying to change anything. Research is led by Tim Gard at Massachusetts General Hospital managed to tease out the brain mechanisms behind pain relief in meditation still further. They used an electrode applied to the forearm of volunteers to deliver focused electric shocks, which apparently feels like being poked with a pin at random intervals. Compared with people who had never meditated, experienced meditators were able to reduce their anxiety levels by 29% as they were awaiting the painful stimulus. While they did this, activity in their ACC increased. When the pain arrived, they were able to use mindful acceptance to reduce its unpleasantness by 22% compared with the controls. They showed decreased activity in their prefrontal cortex and increased activation in the insular and secondary somatosensory cortex, where data from receptors all over the body for stimuli such as pressure, pain, and warmth are processed. The researchers found that the better a meditator was at reducing the unpleasantness of the pain, the more strongly these areas were activated in his or her brain. These changes in the brain neatly reflect the two distinct components of mindfulness meditation: focused attention and open monitoring. Focusing attention on the breath first helps to create a sense of calm, combating anxieties about when the next stab of pain will come, and relaxing the muscles which will lessen the pain when it comes. Its signature in the brain includes increased activation of the ACC, To recap, this region controls focusing and holding attention. By contrast, open monitoring involves tuning into the sensory experience of pain, increased activation of the insular and somatosensory cortex, but with a completely non-judgmental accepting attitude, decreased prefrontal cortex activation. Neuroscientists call this type of regulation, also deployed during emotion regulation in experienced meditators, as we'll see in Chapter 8, bottom-up processing. The rookie meditators, given just 4 20-minute training sessions in Zidane's study, seem to have learned the easy trick of focusing their attention on the breath to reduce their anxiety levels, which would tend to lessen the emotional impact of pain. But in addition, they seem to be attempting some cognitive or top-down control to lessen the pain. This strategy is not unique to meditation and involves reappraising the pain. I can handle this, it's not so bad. A little pain can't do me any harm. Or distracting oneself by focusing on something else, whether that's another bodily sensation like the breath, or a cerebrally demanding task such as mental arithmetic or planning the week's shopping. There is also a placebo effect that comes from simply believing something is going to work. This meditation business is powerful stuff. Having faith in the efficacy of a pill, a medical procedure, a doctor, or a ritual is often enough to evoke real physical and psychological changes, and pain is particularly amenable to such effects. A placebo can ease pain either by triggering the release of endorphins, the body's own painkillers, or by sending a subliminal message to the brain to reappraise it as less unpleasant or harmful. However, a study by Zidane and his colleagues in 2015 suggests that even in beginners, the pain relief provided by mindfulness meditation is more effective than that provided by a placebo alone, and they deploy different top-down cognitive control mechanisms. This goes a long way toward rebuffing claims that meditation is just another way to evoke the placebo effect. As we've seen, experienced meditators don't resort to any kind of top-down cognitive reappraisal strategy, but instead open themselves up completely to the experience of pain without judging it or trying to change it. This attitude was at the heart of the Buddha's teaching about suffering. He taught that through mindfulness one could learn to view both pleasant and painful sensations with equanimity. The idea of non-duality, treating pleasure and pain, triumph and disaster alike, was important to early Hinduism, certainly by the time the Bhagavad Gita was written, perhaps as early as the 5th or 4th century BCE. In this epic tale of war and yoga, Krishna teaches the concept to Prince Arjuna. When the senses contact sense objects, a person experiences cold or heat, pleasure or pain. These experiences are fleeting. They come and go. Bear them patiently, Arjuna. Those who are not affected by these changes, who are the same in pleasure and pain, are truly wise and fit for immortality. In the same vein, attachment to sensory experiences, selfish desire, came to be considered an important source of suffering by Hindus. To judge from this passage, the author of the Bhagavad Gita would have recognized and applauded Siddhartha's first lesson about the perils of desire. When you keep thinking about sense objects, attachment comes. Attachment breeds desire, the lust of possession that burns to anger. Anger clouds the judgment. You can no longer learn from past mistakes. Lost is the power to choose between what is wise and what is unwise, and your life is utter waste. But when you move amidst the world of sense, free from attachment and aversion alike, there comes the peace in which all sorrows end, and you live in the wisdom of the self. We can't know for certain whether these were originally Buddhist ideas or whether they were already becoming widely acknowledged truths among spiritual seekers in the Ganges plain in the 6th and 5th centuries BCE. This uncertainty leaves us to wonder what the Buddha taught his old friends in the deer park that so stirred them they were persuaded to abandon their path and accompany him on his. They had all been practicing the yoga taught by sages such as Alara Kalama and Udaka Ramaputta with a view to escaping samsara, the painful cycle of birth, death, and rebirth. Short of building a time machine, we likely will never know what unique additions Siddhartha made to the methods and beliefs about enlightenment that were already practiced among the renouncers. He would certainly place a greater emphasis on the power of loving kindness and compassion to bring his followers closer to enlightenment. But some historians have argued that the key Buddhist innovation was the open monitoring component of mindfulness. According to this view, Buddhist meditation was about working with the mind, whereas the practice of meditation in Jainism and the yoga of Vedic tradition was concerned with silencing the mind. Like his fellow ascetics, Siddhartha had been using brute force to suppress his senses and his mind's natural tendencies by starving himself almost to death and even trying to stop his breathing. But this top-down strategy had failed miserably. His breakthrough came only with the realization that if he exposed the fetters of desire and pain to the intense spotlight of non-judgmental, mindful awareness, they fell away. It seems the aging Kondanya already had an inkling of this. For when Siddhartha had finished speaking, Kondanya replied with a powerful insight, which can be paraphrased as, "Whatever arises in the mind's awareness will also cease." With these words, he was not only acknowledging that all mental phenomena are impermanent, but also observing that they fade more quickly in the bright light of conscious awareness. The Buddha responded excitedly, "Kondanya knows! Kondanya truly knows!" His old friend was within touching distance of enlightenment. The realization of non-duality was certainly already established as a goal of meditation by the time the Bhagavad Gita was written, but Siddhartha seems to have hit upon an effective way to achieve this happy state that didn't involve the devotee dragging his body to death's door. The Brahmins probably wouldn't have had any problem with this new approach. They may even have welcomed it, though they balked at his establishment some years later of a Buddhist monastic order for women, his rejection of India's caste system, and his dispensing with the Brahmin practice of sacrificing animals in holy fires. All these went against the established order. But Siddhartha espoused another revolutionary idea that was much more unpalatable to them than any of these innovations. In the course of his inward investigations, he had discovered something that, if you were to believe it, and most of us still don't, shattered their worldview and was regarded as heresy. He had discovered he didn't have a self. Guided meditation, open-minded. A great way to return your mind to its ground state, neither overexcited nor torpid, simply alert and open, is to become aware of the natural rhythm of the breath as you inhale and exhale. See Guided Meditation, Only the Breath, page 56. This is focused attention, a prerequisite of the second stage of mindfulness meditation, insight. Take up your position on a cushion or in a chair. Start by focusing on the sensation of the breath entering and leaving your body of the nostrils. Remember, you are observing your breathing rather than controlling it. Follow each inhalation and each exhalation from the start to the finish. Notice any slight gap between the in-breath and the out-breath. Don't be hard on yourself if your mind wanders or you get distracted by a noise. This is all perfectly normal. Just remind yourself, that's how the mind works. and return to the breath. With repetition, you will get better at noticing when you have lost focus and develop greater mindfulness of the present moment. Now that you have quieted your mind, allow your attention to broaden. Whenever a positive or negative feeling arises, make it the focus of your meditation, noticing the bodily sensations associated with it. Perhaps a tightness, the heart beating faster or slower, butterflies in the stomach, relaxed or tensed muscles. Whatever it is, address the feeling with friendly, objective curiosity. You could silently label whatever arises in the mind. For example, there is anxiety, there is calm, there is joy, there is boredom. Remember, everything is on the table. Nothing is beneath your attention. If you experience an ache or a pain, an itch or any other kind of discomfort, treat it in exactly the same way. Turn the spotlight of your attention onto the sensation, but don't allow yourself to get caught up in it. Imagine that on the in-breath you are gently breathing air into the location where the sensations are strongest, then expelling it on the out-breath. You may notice that when you explore the sensation with friendly curiosity, not trying to change it in any way, neither clinging to it nor repressing it, the feeling will start to fade of its own accord. When it is gone, return your full attention to the breath. Mindfulness instructors sometimes talk about surfing the wave of an unpleasant sensation such as pain, anxiety, or craving. Instead of allowing yourself to be overwhelmed by the wave of feeling, you get up on your mental surfboard and ride it. You experience it fully, but your mind remains detached, dignified, and balanced. Knowing that the power of even the most fearsome wave eventually dissipates, you ride it out. If a thought, emotion, or feeling becomes too strong or intrusive, you can always use the breath as a calm refuge, returning your whole attention to the breathing sensations at your nostrils. Similarly, if you feel you can't cope with a pain such as stiffness in your legs, neck, or back, shift your posture accordingly. But make your intention to move a mindful choice rather than a reflex, and make the movement itself slow and deliberate. Chapter 5. The Man Who Disappeared. The putting away of that pride which comes from the thought, I am, this truly is the highest happiness. The Mahavagga, Chapter 1, Part 3, translated by T.W. Rhys-Davids. On the day he arrived after his long walk from Uruvela, later known as Bodh Gaya, Siddhartha arranged for their encampment to be relocated within the shelter of a monumental banyan tree. For the next 3 days, protected from the sun and the monsoon rains, adequately fed and carefully instructed, his 5 disciples regained their strength and morale. On the 4th morning, when they returned from the town, Siddhartha judged them ready to learn of the final insights they must realize in order to attain enlightenment. The body is not the self, he begins. If this body were the self, the eternal essence of a person, their soul, would it be subject to so much disease and change? Would it be beyond our control, perishable? Would it be the cause of so much suffering and unsatisfactoriness, just like everything else that is impermanent by nature? No, venerable sir, they reply, it would not. Whatever form the body has taken or takes or will take, Siddhartha tells them, you surely have to conclude, this is not mine, this is not I, this is not myself. He then asks them to scrutinize each of the 4 remaining components of a sentient being in turn and judge for themselves whether it is permanent or impermanent. Feeling, perception, thoughts, consciousness. Impermanent, they respond every time. So if there is no refuge of stability to be found in any of the 5 components, he says, Where could the supposedly eternal, unchanging self possibly reside within a human being? Everywhere one looks, whether in the body or the mind, one sees only change and instability. The self is nowhere to be found. For 1,000 years, the central tenet of the Vedic religion of ancient India had remained unchallenged. Inside every human dwells Atman, an essence that is his or her true self. This inner controller is indistinguishable from the ultimate reality, Brahman, which is the supreme soul and ground of all existence. In the deepest, most ecstatic states of meditation, a yogin was said to discard his mundane everyday self and realize his true self, becoming one with Brahman and every other sentient being on earth and in the heavenly realms. The first recorded use of the Sanskrit word Atman was in the Rig Veda,